Paul and I hung in marital limbo, unsure of which direction we'd move in, I pondered the question of my last name, mentally scanning words that sounded good with Cheryl and making lists of characters from novels I admired. Nothing fit until one day when the word strayed came into my mind. Immediately, I looked it up in the dictionary and knew it was mine. Its layered definition spoke directly to my life and also struck a poetic chord. To wander from the proper path, to deviate from the direct course, to be lost, to become wild, to be without a mother or father, to be without a home, to move about aimlessly in search of something, to diverge or digress. I had diverged, digressed, wandered, and become wild. I didn't embrace the word as my new name because it defined negative aspects of my circumstances or life, but because even in my darkest days, those very days in which I was naming myself, I saw the power of the darkness. Saw that, in fact, I had strayed, and that I was astray, and that from the wild places my straying had brought me, I knew things I couldn't have known before. Cheryl strayed, I wrote repeatedly down a whole page of my journal, like a girl with a crush on a boy she hoped to marry. Only the boy didn't exist. I was my own boy, planting a root in the very center of my rootlessness. Still, I had my doubts. To pick a word out of the dictionary and proclaim it mine felt a bit fraudulent to me, a bit childish or foolish, not to mention a touch hypocritical. For years, I'd privately mocked the peers in my hippie, artsy, lefty circles who'd taken on names they'd invented for themselves. Jennifers and Michelles, who became Sequoias and Lunas. Mikes and Jasons, who became Oaks and Thistles. I pressed on anyway, confiding in a few friends about my decision, asking them to begin calling me by my new name to help me test it out. I took a road trip, and each time I happened across a guest book, I signed it Cheryl Strayed, my hand trembling slightly, feeling vaguely guilty, as if I were forging a check. By the time Paul and I decided to file our divorce papers, I'd broken in my new name enough that I wrote it without hesitation on the blank line. It was the other lines that gave me pause, the endless lines demanding signatures that would dissolve our marriage. Those were the ones I completed with far more trepidation. I didn't exactly want to get divorced. I didn't exactly not want to. I believed in almost equal measure both that divorcing Paul was the right thing to do, and that by doing so, I was destroying the best thing I had. By then, my marriage had become like the trail in that moment when I realized there was a bull in both directions. I simply made a leap of faith and pushed on in the direction where I'd never been. The day we signed our divorce papers, it was April in Minneapolis and snowing. The flakes coming down in thick swirls, enchanting the city. We sat across a table from a woman named Val, who was an acquaintance of ours and also, as it happened, licensed as a notary public. We watched the snow from a wide window in her office downtown, making little jokes when we could. I'd met Val only a few times before. I knew glimmers of things about her that jumbled together in my mind. She was cute, blunt, and impossibly tiny, at least a decade older than us. Her hair was an inch long and bleached blonde, except for a longer hank of it that was dyed pink and swooped down like a little wing over her eyes. Silver earrings rimmed her ears, and a throng of multicolored tattoos etched her arms like sleeves. This, and yet she had an actual job in an actual office downtown, with a big wide window and a notary public license to boot. We chose her to officiate our divorce because we wanted it to be easy. We wanted it to be cool. We wanted to believe that we were still gentle, good people in the world, that everything we'd said to each other 6 years before had been true. What was it we said? We'd asked each other a few weeks before, half drunk in my apartment, where we'd decided once and for all that we were going through with this. "Here it is," I'd yelled after riffling through some papers and finding the wedding vows we'd written ourselves, three faded pages stapled together. We'd given them a title, "The Day the Daisies Bloomed." "The Day the Daisies Bloomed," I hooted, and we laughed so hard at ourselves, at the people we used to be. And then I set the vows back on top of the pile where I'd found them, unable to read on. We'd married so young, so uncharacteristically. Even our parents asked why we couldn't just live together. We couldn't just live together, even though I was only 19 and he 21. We were too wildly in love, and we believed we had to do something wild to demonstrate that. So we did the wildest thing we could think of and got married. But even married, we didn't think of ourselves as married people. We were monogamous, but we had no intention of settling down. We packed our bicycles into boxes and flew them to Ireland, where a month later I turned 20. We rented a flat in Galway and then changed our minds and moved to Dublin and got a matching pair of restaurant jobs, he in a pizza place, me in a vegetarian cafe. 4 months later, we moved to London and walked the streets so destitute we searched for coins on the sidewalk. Eventually, we returned home, and not long after that, my mother died, and we did all the things that we did that led us here, to Val's office. Paul and I had clutched each other's hands beneath the table, watching Val as she methodically examined our do-it-yourself, no-fault divorce documents. She inspected one page and then the next, and on through 50 or 60, making sure we'd gotten everything right. I felt a kind of loyalty rear up in me as she did this, unified with Paul against whatever contrary claim she might make, as if we were applying to be together for the rest of our lives instead of the opposite. "It all looks good," she said at last, giving us a reticent smile. And then she went back through the pages again, at a brisker clip this time, pressing her giant notary public stamp against some and sliding dozens of others across the table for us to sign. "I love him," I blurted when we were nearly through, my eyes filling with tears. I thought about pulling up my sleeve and showing her the square of gauze that covered my brand new horse tattoo as proof, but I only stammered on. "I mean, this is not for lack of love, just so you know. I love him, and he loves me." I looked at Paul, waiting for him to interject and agree and declare his love too, but he remained silent. "Just so you know," I repeated, "so you won't get the wrong idea." "I know," Val said, and pushed the pink hank of her hair aside so I could see her eyes fluttering nervously from the papers up to me and then down to the papers again. "And it's all my fault," I said, my voice swelling and shaking. "He didn't do anything. I'm the one. I broke my own heart." Paul reached for me and squeezed my leg, consoling me. I couldn't look at him. If I looked at him, I would cry. We'd agreed to this together, but I knew that if I turned to him and proposed we forget about divorcing and get back together instead, he would agree. I didn't turn. Something inside of me whirred like a machine that I had started but could not stop. I put my head down and placed it on top of Paul's hand on my leg. Sometimes we wondered together if things would have turned out differently if one thing that was true hadn't been true. If my mother hadn't died, for example, would I still have cheated on him? Or if I hadn't cheated on him, would he have cheated on me? And what if nothing had happened? No mother dying, no cheating on anyone. Would we still be getting divorced anyway, having simply married too young? We couldn't know, but we were open to knowing. As close as we'd been when we were together, we were closer in our unraveling, telling each other everything at last, words that seemed to us might never have been spoken between two human beings before. So deep we went, saying everything that was beautiful and ugly and true. "Now that we've been through all this, we should stay together," I half-joked in the tender wake of our last heart-rending, soul-bearing discussion. the one we'd had to decide at last whether or not to get divorced. We were sitting on the couch in the dark of my apartment, having talked through the afternoon and into the evening, both of us too shattered by the time the sun set to get up and switch on a light.
"I hope you can do that someday, with someone else," I said when he didn't reply, though the very thought of that someone else pierced my heart.
"I hope you can too," he said.
I sat in the darkness beside him, wanting to believe that I was capable of finding the kind of love I had with him again, only without wrecking it the second time around.
It felt impossible to me.
I thought of my mother, thought of how in the last days of her life, so many horrible things had happened, small horrible things. My mother's whimsical, delirious babblings, the blood pooling to blacken the backs of her bedridden arms,
the way she begged for something that wasn't even mercy,
for whatever it is that is less than mercy, for what we don't even have a word for. Those were the worst days, I believed at the time. And yet, the moment she died, I'd have given anything to have them back. One small, horrible, glorious day after the other. Maybe it would be that way with Paul as well, I thought, sitting beside him on the night we decided to divorce. Maybe once they were over, I'd want these horrible days back too.
"What are you thinking?" he asked.
But I didn't answer. I only leaned over and switched on the light. It was up to us to mail the notarized divorce documents. Together, Paul and I walked out of the building and into the snow, and down the sidewalk until we found a mailbox. Afterwards, we leaned against the cold bricks of a building and kissed, crying and murmuring regrets, our tears mixing together on our faces.
"What are we doing?"
Paul asked after a while.
"Saying goodbye," I said.
I thought of asking him to go back to my apartment with me, as we'd done a few times over the course of our year-long separation, falling into bed together for a night or an afternoon, but I didn't have the heart.
"Goodbye," he said.
"Bye," I said.
We stood close together, face to face, my hands gripping the front of his coat. I could feel the dumb ferocity of the building on one side of me, the gray sky and the white streets like a giant slumbering beast on the other, and us between them, alone together in a tunnel. Snowflakes were melting onto his hair, and I wanted to reach up and touch them, but I didn't. We stood there without saying anything, looking into each other's eyes as if it would be the last time.
"Cheryl Strayed," he said after a long while, my new name so strange on his tongue. I nodded and let go of his coat. Chapter 7. The Only Girl in the Woods.
"Cheryl Strayed?" the woman at the Kennedy Meadows General Store asked, without a smile. When I nodded exuberantly, she turned and disappeared into the back without another word. I looked around, drunk with the sight of the packaged food and drinks, feeling a combination of anticipation over the things I'd consume in the coming hours, and relief over the fact that my pack was no longer attached to my body, but resting now on the porch of the store. I was here. I had made it to my first stop. It seemed like a miracle. I'd half expected to see Greg, Matt, and Albert at the store, but they were nowhere in sight. My guidebook explained that the campground was another 3 miles farther on, and I assumed that's where I'd find them, along with Doug and Tom eventually. Thanks to my exertions, they hadn't managed to catch up with me. Kennedy Meadows was a pretty expanse of piney woods and sage and grass meadows at an elevation of 6,200 feet on the South Fork Kern River. It wasn't a town, but rather an outpost of civilization, spread out over a few miles, consisting of a general store, a restaurant called Grumpy's, and a primitive campground. "Here you go," the woman said, returning with my box and setting it on the counter. "It's the only one that's got a girl's name on it. That's how I knew." She reached across the counter to me. "This came, too."
In her hand was a postcard. I took it and read it. "I hope you made it this far," it said in a familiar scrawl. I want to be your clean boyfriend someday. I love you, Joe. On the other side was a photograph of the Sylvia Beach Hotel on the Oregon coast, where we'd stayed together once. I stared at the photograph for several moments, a series of feelings washing over me in waves. Grateful for a word from someone I knew, nostalgic for Joe, disappointed that only one person had written to me, and heartbroken, unreasonable as it was, that the one person who had wasn't Paul. I bought 2 bottles of Snapple lemonade, a king-size Butterfinger, and a bag of Doritos, and went outside and sat on the front steps, devouring the things I'd purchased while reading the postcard over and over again. After a while, I noticed a box in the corner of the porch stuffed full with mostly packaged backpacker food. Above it, there was a handwritten sign that said, PCT Hiker Free Box. Leave what you don't want. Take what you do. A ski pole was propped behind the box. Precisely the thing I needed. It was a ski pole fit for a princess, white with a bubblegum pink nylon wrist strap. I tested it out for a few steps. It was the perfect height. It would help me across not only the snow, but also the many stream fords and rock slides that no doubt lay ahead. I walked with it an hour later as I made my way along the dirt road that went in a loop around the campground, looking for Greg, Matt, and Albert. It was a Sunday afternoon in June, but the place was mostly empty. I passed by a man preparing his fishing gear and a couple with a cooler of beer and a boombox, and eventually came to a campsite where a shirtless gray-haired man with a big tan belly sat at a picnic table reading a book. He looked up as I approached. "You must be the famous Cheryl of the enormous backpack," he called to me. I laughed in agreement. "I'm Ed." He walked toward me to shake my hand. "Your friends are here. They all just caught a ride up to the store. You must have missed them as you were coming, but they asked me to watch for you. You can set up your tent right over there if you'd like. They're all camped here, Greg and Albert and his son." He gestured to the tents around him. "We were taking bets who'd arrive first, you or the 2 boys from back east coming up behind you." "Who won?" I asked. Ed thought for a moment. "No one," he said, and boomed with laughter. "None of us bet on you." I rested Monster on the picnic table, took it off, and left it there, so when I had put it on again, I wouldn't have to perform my pathetic deadlift from the ground. "Welcome to my humble abode," Ed said, gesturing to a little pop-up trailer that had a tarp roof extending out its side with a makeshift camp kitchen beneath it. "You hungry?" There were no showers at the campground, so while Ed made lunch for me, I walked to the river to wash as best as I could with my clothes still on. The river felt like a shock after all that dry territory I'd crossed. And the South Fork Kern River wasn't just any river. It was violent and self-possessed, ice cold and raging, its might clear evidence of the heavy snows higher up the mountains. The current was too fast to go in, even ankle deep, so I walked down the bank until I found an eddying pool near the river's edge and waded in. My feet ached from the cold water and eventually went numb. I crouched and wetted down my filthy hair and splashed handfuls of water beneath my clothes to wash my body. I felt electric with sugar and the victory of arriving, filled with anticipation of the conversations I'd have over the next couple of days. When I was done, I walked up the bank and then across a wide meadow, wet and cool. I could see Ed from a distance, and as I approached, I watched him move from his camp kitchen to the picnic table with plates of food in his hands, bottles of ketchup and mustard, and cans of Coke. I'd known him only a few minutes, and yet, like the other men I'd met, he felt instantly familiar to me, as if I could trust him with close to anything. We sat across from each other and ate while he told me about himself. He was 50, an amateur poet and seasonal vagabond, childless and divorced. I tried to eat at his leisurely pace, taking bites when he did, the same way I'd attempted to match my steps to Greg's a few days before, but I couldn't do it. I was ravenous. I devoured 2 hot dogs and a mountain of baked beans and another mountain of potato chips in a flash, and then sat hungrily wishing for more. Meanwhile, Ed worked his way languidly through his lunch, pausing to open his journal to read aloud poems that he'd composed the day before. He lived in San Diego most of the year, he explained. But each summer, he set up camp in Kennedy Meadows in order to greet the PCT hikers as they passed through. He was what's referred to in PCT hiker vernacular as a trail angel. But I didn't know that then. Didn't know even that there was a PCT hiker vernacular. "Look here, fellas, we all lost the bet," Ed hollered to the men when they returned from the store. "I didn't lose," Greg protested as he came close to squeeze my shoulder. "I put my money on you, Cheryl," he insisted, though the others disputed his claim. We sat around the picnic table talking about the trail, and after a while they all dispersed to take naps, Ed to his trailer, Greg, Albert, and Matt to their tents. I stayed at the picnic table, too excited to sleep, pawing through the contents of the box I'd packed weeks before. The things inside smelled like a world far off, like the one I'd occupied in what seemed another lifetime, scented with the Nag Champa incense that had permeated my apartment. The Ziploc bags and packaging on the food were still shiny and unscathed. The fresh t-shirt smelled of the lavender detergent I bought in bulk at the co-op I belonged to in Minneapolis. The flowery cover of the Complete Stories of Flannery O'Connor was unbent. The same could not be said of Faulkner's As I Lay Dying, or rather the thin portion of the book I still had in my pack. I'd torn off the cover and all the pages I'd read the night before and burned them in the little aluminum pie pan I'd brought to place beneath my stove to safeguard against errant sparks. I'd watched Faulkner's name disappear into flames, feeling a bit like it was a sacrilege. Never had I dreamed I'd be burning books. But I was desperate to lighten my load. I'd done the same with the section from The Pacific Crest Trail, Volume 1, California, that I'd already hiked. It hurt to do it, but it had to be done. I'd loved books in my regular pre-PCT life, but on the trail, they'd taken on even greater meaning. They were the world I could lose myself in when the one I was actually in became too lonely or harsh or difficult to bear. When I made camp in the evenings, I rushed through the tasks of pitching my tent and filtering water and cooking dinner so I could sit afterwards inside the shelter of my tent in my chair with my pot of hot food gripped between my knees. I ate with my spoon in one hand and a book in the other, reading by the light of my headlamp when the sky darkened. In the first week of my hike, I was often too exhausted to read more than a page or two before I fell asleep. But as I grew stronger, I was reading more, eager to escape the tedium of my days. And each morning, I burned whatever I'd read the night before. As I held my unspoiled copy of O'Connor's short stories, Albert emerged from his tent. "Looks to me like you could stand to lose a few things," he said. "Want some help?" "Actually," I said, smiling ruefully at him, "yes." "All right, then. Here's what I want you to do. Pack up that thing just like you're about to hike out of here for this next stretch of trail, and we'll go from there." He walked toward the river with the nub of a toothbrush in hand, the end of which he'd thought to break off to save weight, of course. I went to work, integrating the new with the old, feeling as if I were taking a test that I was bound to fail. When I was done, Albert returned and methodically unpacked my pack. He placed each item in one of 2 piles, one to go back into my pack, another to go into the now empty resupply box that I could either mail home or leave in the PCT hiker free box on the porch of the Kennedy Meadows General Store for others to plunder. Into the box went the foldable saw and miniature binoculars and the megawatt flash for the camera I had yet to use. As I looked on, Albert chucked aside the deodorant whose powers I'd overestimated and the disposable razor I'd brought with some vague notion about shaving my legs and under my arms and, much to my embarrassment,
the fat roll of condoms I'd slipped into my first aid kit.
"Do you really need these?" Albert asked, holding the condoms.
Albert, the Georgia Daddy Eagle Scout, whose wedding band glinted in the sun, who cut off the handle of his own toothbrush, but no doubt carried a pocket-sized Bible in his pack. He looked at me stone-faced as a soldier, while the white plastic wrappers of a dozen ultra-thin, non-lubricated Trojan condoms made a clickety-clack sound as they unfurled like a party streamer from his hand.
"No," I said, feeling as if I was going to die of shame. The idea of having sex seemed absurd to me now, though when I'd packed my supplies, it had struck me as a reasonable prospect back before I had a clue of what hiking the Pacific Crest Trail would do to my body. I'd not seen myself since I was at the motel in Ridgecrest, but after the men had gone off to nap, I'd taken the opportunity to gaze at my face in the mirror attached to the side of Ed's truck. I looked tan and dirty, despite my recent dunk in the river. I'd become remotely leaner and my dark blonde hair a tad lighter, alternately flattened and sprung alive by a combination of dried sweat, river water, and dust. I didn't look like a woman who might need 12 condoms. But Albert didn't pause to ponder such things, whether I'd get laid or not, whether I was pretty. He pushed on, pillaging my pack, inquiring sternly each time before tossing another item I'd previously deemed necessary into the get-rid-of pile. I nodded almost every time he held an item up, agreeing it should go, though I held the line on both the complete stories and my beloved intact copy of The Dream of a Common Language. I held the line on my journal in which I recorded everything I did that summer, and when Albert wasn't looking, I tore one condom off the end of the fat roll of condoms he'd tossed aside and slid it discreetly into the back pocket of my shorts.
"So what brought you out here?" Albert asked when his work was done. He sat on the bench of the picnic table, his broad hands folded in front of him.
"To hike the PCT?" I asked. He nodded and watched as I pushed the various items we'd agreed I could keep back into my pack.
"I'll tell you why I'm doing it," he said quickly before I could answer. "It's been a lifelong dream for me. When I heard about the trail, I thought, now there's something I'd like to do before I go to meet the Lord." He rapped his fist gently on the table. "So how about you, girlio? I've got a theory that most folks have a reason. Something that drove them out here."
"I don't know," I demurred. I wasn't about to tell a 50-something Christian Georgia Eagle Scout why I decided to walk alone in the woods for 3 solid months, no matter how kindly his eyes twinkled when he smiled. The things that compelled me to hike this trail would sound scandalous to him and dubious to me. To both of us, they'd only reveal just how shaky this whole endeavor was.
"Mainly," I said, "I thought it would be something fun."
"You call this fun?" he asked, and we both laughed.
I turned and leaned into Monster, threading my arms into the straps.
"So, let's see if it made a difference," I said, and buckled it on. When I lifted it from the table, I was amazed at how light it felt, even fully loaded with my new ice axe and a fresh supply of 11 days' worth of food. I beamed at Albert.
"Thank you."
He chuckled in response, shaking his head. Jubilant, I walked away to take my pack on a trial run on the dirt road that made a loop around the campground. Mine was still the biggest pack of the bunch. Hiking solo, I had to carry things that those who hiked in pairs could divvy up, and I didn't have the ultralight confidence or skills that Greg did. But in comparison to how my pack had been before Albert helped me purge it, it was so light I felt I could leap into the air. Halfway around the loop, I paused and leapt. I made it only an inch off the ground, but at least it could be done.
"Cheryl?" a voice called out just then.
I looked up and saw a handsome young man wearing a backpack walking toward me.
"Doug?" I asked, guessing right. In response, he waved his arms and gave out a joyous hoot, and then he walked straight up to me and pulled me in for a hug.
"We read your entry in the register, and we've been trying to catch up to you."
"And here I am," I stammered, taken aback by his enthusiasm and good looks.
"We're all camped over there," I gestured behind me. "There's a bunch of us.
Where's your friend?
He'll be coming up soon, Doug said, and hooted again, apropos of nothing. He reminded me of all the golden boys I'd known in my life, classically handsome and charmingly sure of his place at the very top of the heap, confident that the world was his and that he was safe in it, without ever having considered otherwise. As I stood next to him, I had the feeling that any moment he'd reach for my hand and together we'd parachute off a cliff, laughing as we wafted gently down.
Tom, Doug bellowed when he saw a figure appear down the road.
Together, we walked toward him. I could tell even from a distance that Tom was Doug's physical and spiritual opposite, bony, pale, bespectacled. The smile that crept onto his face as we approached was cautious and mildly unconvinced. Hello, he said to me when we got close enough, reaching to shake my hand. In the few short minutes it took for us to reach Ed's camp, we exchanged a flurry of information about who we were and where we were from. Tom was 24, Doug 21. New England blue bloods, my mother would have called them, I knew almost before they told me a thing. Which meant to her only that they were basically rich and from somewhere east of Ohio and north of D.C. Over the course of the coming days, I'd learn all about them. How their parents were surgeons and mayors and financial executives. How they'd both attended a Tony boarding school whose fame was so great even I knew it by name. How they'd vacationed on Nantucket and on private islands off the coast of Maine and spent their spring breaks in Vail. But I didn't know any of that yet. How in so many ways their lives were unfathomable to me and mine to them. I knew only that in some very particular ways, they were my closest kin. They weren't gearheads or backpacking experts or PCT know-it-alls. They hadn't hiked all the way from Mexico, nor had they been planning the trip for a decade. And even better, the miles they'd traversed so far had left them nearly as shattered as they'd left me. They hadn't, by virtue of their togetherness, gone days without seeing another human being. Their packs looked of a size reasonable enough that I doubted they were carrying a foldable saw. But I could tell the instant I locked eyes with Doug that, despite all his confidence and ease, he had been through something. And when Tom took my hand to shake it, I could read precisely the expression on his face. It said, "I've got to get these fucking boots off my feet." Moments later, he did, sitting on the bench of Ed's picnic table, after we arrived at our camp and the men gathered around to introduce themselves. I watched as Tom carefully peeled off his filthy socks, clumps of worn-out moleskin, and his own flesh coming off with them. His feet looked like mine, white as fish and pocked with bloody, oozing wounds, overlaid with flaps of skin that had been rubbed away and now dangled, still painfully attached to the patches of flesh that had yet to die a slow PCT-induced death. I took off my pack and unzipped a pocket to remove my first aid kit. "Have you ever tried these?" I asked Tom, holding out a sheet of second skin. Thankfully, I'd packed more into my resupply box. "These have saved me," I explained. "I don't know if I could go on without them, actually." Tom only looked up at me in despair and nodded without elaborating. I set a couple of sheets of second skin beside him on the bench. "You're welcome to these if you'd like," I said, seeing them in their translucent blue wrappers brought to mind the condom in my back pocket. I wondered if Tom had packed any, if Doug had, if my bringing them had been such a dumb idea after all. Being in Tom and Doug's presence made it seem slightly less so. "We thought we'd all go up to Grumpy's at 6, Ed said, looking at his watch. "We've got a couple of hours. I'll drive us all up in my truck." He looked at Tom and Doug. "Meanwhile, I'd be happy to get you boys a snack." The men sat at the picnic table eating Ed's potato chips and cold baked beans, talking about why they chose the pack they chose and the pros and cons of each. Someone brought out a deck of cards and a game of poker started up. Greg paged through his guidebook at the end of the table near me, where I stood beside my pack, still marveling at its transformation. Pockets that had been bursting full now had tiny cushions of room. "You're practically a Jardy Nazi now," said Albert in a teasing tone, seeing me gazing at my pack.
Those are the disciples of Ray Jardine, if you don't know. They take a highly particular view about pack weight.
It's the guy I was telling you about, added Greg.
I nodded coolly, trying to conceal my ignorance. I'm going to get ready for dinner, I said, and ambled to the edge of our campsite. I pitched my tent and then crawled inside, spread out my sleeping bag, and lay on top of it, staring at the green nylon ceiling, while listening to the murmur of the men's conversation and occasional bursts of laughter. I was going out to a restaurant with 6 men, and I had nothing to wear but what I was already wearing, I realized glumly, a t-shirt over a sports bra and a pair of shorts with nothing underneath. I remembered my fresh t-shirt from my resupply box and sat up and put it on. The entire back of the shirt I'd been wearing since Mojave was now stained a brownish yellow from the endless bath of sweat it had endured. I wadded it up in a ball and put it at the corner of my tent. I'd throw it away at the store later. The only other clothes I had were those I brought for cold weather. I remembered the necklace I'd been wearing until it got so hot that I couldn't bear to have it on. I found it in the Ziploc bag in which I kept my driver's license and money and put it on. It was a small turquoise and silver earring that used to belong to my mother. I'd lost the other one, so I'd taken a pair of needle-nose pliers to the one that remained and turned it into a pendant on a delicate silver chain. I'd brought it along because it had been my mother's. Having it with me felt meaningful. But now I was glad to have it simply because I felt prettier with it on. I ran my fingers through my hair, attempting to shape it into an attractive formation, aided by my tiny comb. But eventually I gave up and pushed it behind my ears. It was just as well, I knew, that I simply let myself look and feel and smell the way I did. I was, after all, what Ed referred to somewhat inaccurately as the only girl in the woods, alone with a gang of men. By necessity, out here on the trail, I felt I had to sexually neutralize the men I met by being, to the extent that was possible, one of them. I'd never been that way in my life, interacting with men in the even-keeled indifference that being one of the guys entails. It didn't feel like an easy thing to endure as I sat in my tent while the men played cards. I'd been a girl forever, after all, familiar with and reliant upon the powers my very girlness granted me. Suppressing those powers gave me a gloomy twinge in the gut. Being one of the guys meant I could not go on being the woman I'd become expert at being among men. It was a version of myself I'd first tasted way back when I was a child of 11, and I'd felt that prickly rush of power when grown men would turn their heads to look at me, or whistle, or say, "Hey, pretty baby," just loudly enough that I could hear. The one I'd banked on all through high school, starving myself thin, playing cute and dumb so I'd be popular and loved. The one I'd fostered all through my young adult years while trying on different costumes. Earth girl, punk girl, cowgirl, riot girl, ballsy girl. The one for whom behind every hot pair of boots or sexy little skirt or flourish of the hair, there was a trap door that led to the least true version of me. Now there was only one version. On the PCT, I had no choice but to inhabit it entirely to show my grubby face to the whole wide world, which, at least for now, consisted of only 6 men. "Cheryl?" Doug's voice called softly from a few feet away. "You in there?" "Yeah," I replied. "We're going down to the river. Come hang with us." "Okay," I said, feeling flattered in spite of myself. When I sat up, the condom made a crinkling sound in my back pocket. I took it out and slid it into my first aid kit, crawled out of my tent, and walked toward the river. Doug, Tom, and Greg were waiting in the shallow spot where I had cleaned up a few hours before. Beyond them, the water raged in torrents, rushing over boulders as big as my tent. I thought of the snow I'd soon be encountering if I continued on with the ice axe I didn't yet know how to use, and the white ski pole with its cute little pink wrist strap that had come to me only by chance. I hadn't yet begun to think about what was next on the trail. I'd only listened and nodded when Ed told me that most of the PCT hikers who'd come through Kennedy Meadows in the 3 weeks he'd been camped here had opted to get off the trail at this point because of the record snowpack that made the trail essentially unpassable for most of the next 400 or 500 miles. They caught rides and buses to rejoin the PCT farther north, at lower elevations, he told me. Some intended to loop back later in the summer to hike the section they'd missed, others to skip it. He said that a few had ended their hikes altogether, just as Greg had told me earlier, deciding to hike the PCT another less record-breaking year. And fewer still had forged ahead, determined to make it through the snow. Grateful for my cheap camp sandals, I picked my way over the rocks that lined the riverbed toward the men, the water so cold my bones hurt. "I got something for you," said Doug when I reached him. He held his hand out to me. In it was a shiny feather, about a foot long, so black it shone blue in the sun. "For what?" I asked, taking it from him. "For luck," he said, and touched my arm. When he took his hand away, the place where it had been felt like a burn. I could feel how little I'd been touched in the past 14 days, how alone I'd been. "So I was thinking about the snow," I said, holding the feather, my voice raised over the rush of the river. "The people who bypassed, they were all here a week or two before us. A lot more snow has melted by now, so maybe it'll be okay." I looked at Greg, and then at the black feather, stroking it. "The snow depth at Bighorn Plateau on June 1st was more than double what it was the same day last year," he said, tossing a stone. "A week isn't going to make much of a difference in that regard." I nodded, as if I knew where Bighorn Plateau was or what it meant for the snowpack to be double what it was a year ago. I felt like a fraud even having this discussion, like a mascot among players, as if they were the real PCT hikers and I was just happening through. As if somehow because of my inexperience, my failure to read even a single page written by Ray Jardine, my laughably slow pace, and my belief that it had been reasonable to pack a foldable saw, I had not actually hiked to Kennedy Meadows from Tehachapi Pass, but instead had been carried along. But I had walked here, and I wasn't ready to give up on seeing the High Sierra just yet. It had been the section of the trail I'd most anticipated, its untouched beauty extolled by the authors of the Pacific Crest Trail, Volume 1, California, and immortalized by the naturalist John Muir in the books he'd written a century before. It was the section of mountains he dubbed the Range of Light. The High Sierra and its 13,000 and 14,000-foot high peaks, its cold, clear lakes, and deep canyons were the point of hiking the PCT in California, it seemed. Plus, bypassing it would be a logistical mess. If I had to skip the High Sierra, I'd end up in Ashland more than a month before I intended to. "I'd like to push on if there's a way," I said, waving the feather with a flourish. My feet didn't hurt anymore. They'd gone blissfully numb in the icy water.
"Well, we do have about 40 miles to play with before the going gets seriously rough, from here up to Trail Pass," said Doug. "There's a trail there that intersects the PCT and goes downward to a campground. We can hike at least that far and see how it goes, see how much snow there is, and then bail out there if we want to."
"What do you think of that, Greg?" I asked. Whatever he would do was what I'd do. He nodded.
"I think that's a good plan."
"That's what I'm going to do," I said. "I'll be okay. I have my ice axe now." Greg looked at me.
"You know how to use it?"
The next morning, he gave me a tutorial. "This is the shaft," he said, running his hand up the length of the axe. "And this is the spike," he added, touching a finger to the sharp end. "And on the other end, there's the head."
The shaft, the head, the spike? I tried not to crack up like an eighth grader in sex ed class, but I couldn't help myself.
"What?" asked Greg, his hand around the shaft of his axe, but I only shook my head.
"You've got two edges," he continued. "The blunt edge is the adze. That's what you use to chop your steps. And the other edge is the pick. That's what you use to save your ass when you're sliding off the side of the mountain."
He spoke in a tone that assumed I knew this already, as if he were just reviewing the basics before we got started. "Yep, the shaft, the head, the spike, the pick, the adze," I said.
"The adze," he corrected. "There's a Z."
We were standing on a steep bank along the river, the closest thing we could find to simulate an icy slope.
Now let's say you're falling, said Greg, throwing himself down the incline to demonstrate. As he fell, he jammed the pick into the mud. You want to dig that pick in as hard as you can, while holding onto the shaft with one hand and the head with the other, like this. And once you're anchored in, you try to get your footing.
I looked at him. What if you can't get your footing?
Well, then you hold on here, he answered, moving his hands on the axe.
What if I can't hold on that long? I mean, I'll have my pack and everything, and actually, I'm not strong enough to do a single pull-up.
You hold on, he said dispassionately. Unless you'd rather slide off the side of the mountain.
I got to work. Again and again, I threw myself against the increasingly muddy slope, pretending that I was slipping on ice, and again, I planted the pick of my ice axe into the soil while Greg watched, coaching and critiquing my technique.
Doug and Tom sat nearby, pretending they weren't paying attention. Albert and Matt were lying on a tarp we'd spread out for them beneath the shade of a tree near Ed's truck, too ill to move anywhere but to the outhouse several times an hour.
They'd both woken in the middle of the night, sick with what we were all beginning to believe was Giardia, a waterborne parasite that causes crippling diarrhea and nausea, requires prescription medication to cure, and almost always means a week or more off the trail. It was the reason PCT hikers spent so much time talking about water purifiers and water sources, for fear they'd make one wrong move and have to pay. I didn't know where Matt and Albert had picked up whatever they had, but I prayed I hadn't picked it up too. By late afternoon, we all stood over them as they lay pale and limp on their tarp, convincing them it was time they got to the hospital in Ridgecrest. Too sick to resist, they watched as we packed their things and loaded their packs into the back of Ed's truck.
Thank you for all your help with lightening my pack, I said to Albert, when we had a moment alone before he departed. He looked wanly up at me from his bed on the tarp. I couldn't have done it myself. He gave me a weak smile and nodded. By the way, I said, I wanted to tell you about why I decided to hike the PCT. I got divorced. I was married, and not long ago I got divorced, and also, about 4 years ago my mom died. She was only 45, and she got cancer suddenly and died. It's been a hard time in my life, and I've sort of gotten off track, so I...
He opened his eyes wider, looking at me.
I thought it would help me find my center to come out here.
I made a crumpled gesture with my hands out of words, a bit surprised that I'd let so many tumble out.
Well, you've got your bearings now, haven't you? He said, and sat up, his face lighting up despite his nausea.
He rose and walked slowly to Ed's truck and got in beside his son. I clambered into the back with their backpacks and the box of things I no longer needed, and rode with them as far as the general store. When we reached it, Ed stopped for a few moments. I jumped out with my box and waved to Albert and Matt, hollering, "Good luck!"
I felt a stinging rush of affection as I watched them drive away. Ed would return in a few hours, but most likely, I'd never see Albert and Matt again. I would be hiking into the High Sierra with Doug and Tom the next day, and in the morning I'd have to say goodbye to Ed and Greg, too. Greg was laying over in Kennedy Meadows another day, and though he would certainly catch up to me, it would likely be a fleeting visit, and then he, too, would pass out of my life. I walked to the porch of the general store and put everything but the foldable saw, the special high-tech flash for my camera, and the miniature binoculars into the PCT Hiker free box. Those I packed into my old resupply box and addressed it to Lisa in Portland. As I sealed my box with a roll of tape Ed had loaned me, I kept having the feeling that something was missing. Later, as I walked the road back to the campground, I realized what it was: the fat roll of condoms. Every last one was gone.
Part 3. Range of Light. We are now in the mountains, and they are in us. John Muir, my first summer in the Sierra. If your nerve deny you, go above your nerve. Emily Dickinson.
Chapter 8. Corvidology. Kennedy Meadows is called the gateway to the High Sierra, and early the next morning I walked through that gate. Doug and Tom accompanied me for the first quarter mile, but then I stopped, telling them to go on ahead because I had to get something for my pack. We embraced and wished one another well, saying goodbye forever or for 15 minutes, we didn't know. I leaned against a boulder to lift some of Monster's weight from my back, watching them go. Their leaving made me melancholy, though I also felt something like relief when they disappeared into the dark trees. I hadn't needed to get anything from my pack. I'd only wanted to be alone. Alone had always felt like an actual place to me, as if it weren't a state of being, but rather a room where I could retreat to be who I really was. The radical aloneness of the PCT had altered that sense. Alone wasn't a room anymore, but the whole wide world. And now I was alone in that world, occupying it in a way I never had before. Living at large like this, without even a roof over my head, made the world feel both bigger and smaller to me. Until now, I hadn't truly understood the world's vastness, hadn't even understood how vast a mile could be, until each mile was beheld at walking speed. And yet there was also its opposite, the strange intimacy I'd come to have with the trail, the way the pinyon pines and monkey flowers I passed that morning, the shallow streams I crossed, felt familiar and known, though I'd never passed them or crossed them before. I walked in the cool of the morning to the rhythm of my new white ski pole clicking against the trail, feeling the lightened but still ridiculously heavy weight of Monster shift and settle in. When I'd set off that morning, I thought that it would feel different to be on the trail, that the hiking would be easier. My pack was lighter, after all, not only thanks to Albert's purge, but because I no longer needed to carry more than a couple of bottles of water at a time, now that I'd reached a less arid stretch of the trail. But an hour and a half into the day, I stopped for a break, feeling the familiar aches and pains. At the same time, I could ever so slightly feel my body toughening up, just as Greg had promised would happen. It was day one of week three, officially summer, the last week of June, and I was not only in a different season now, but in different country too, ascending higher in the South Sierra wilderness. In the 40 miles between Kennedy Meadows and Trail Pass, I'd climb from an elevation of just over 6,100 feet to nearly 11,000. Even in the heat of that first afternoon back on the trail, I could feel an edge of cool in the air that would no doubt envelop me at night. There was no question. I was in the Sierra now, Muir's beloved range of light. I walked beneath great dark trees that put the smaller plants beneath in almost complete shadow and past wide grassy meadows of wildflowers. I scrambled over snowmelt streams by stepping from one unsteady rock to another, aided by my ski pole. At foot speed, the Sierra Nevada seemed just barely surmountable. I could always take another step. It was only when I rounded a bend and glimpsed the white peaks ahead that I doubted my abilities. Only when I thought how far I had yet to go that I lost faith that I would get there. Doug's and Tom's tracks periodically appeared on the alternately muddy and dusty trail, and by mid-afternoon I came upon them as they sat near a stream, their faces registering surprise when I walked up. I sat next to them and pumped water, and we chatted for a while. "You should camp with us tonight if you catch up with us," said Tom before they hiked on. "I already have caught up to you," I replied, and we laughed. That evening, I strolled into the small clearing where they'd pitched their tents. After dinner, they shared the two beers they'd brought from Kennedy Meadows, giving me swigs as we sat in the dirt bundled in our clothes. As we drank, I wondered which one of them had taken the 11 ultra-thin, non-lubricated Trojan condoms I'd purchased in Portland a few weeks before. It seemed it had to be one of them. The next day, when I was hiking alone, I came to a wide swath of snow on a steep incline, a giant ice-crusted sheath that obliterated the trail. It was like the rock slide, only scarier, a river of ice instead of stones. If I slipped while attempting to cross it, I would slide down the side of the mountain and crash into the boulders far below, or worse, fall farther into who knew what. Air, it seemed, from my vantage point. If I didn't attempt to cross it, I'd have to go back to Kennedy Meadows. That didn't seem like an altogether bad idea. And yet, here I was. Hell, I thought. Bloody hell. I took out my ice axe and studied my course, which really only meant standing there for several minutes, working up the nerve. I could see that Doug and Tom had made it across, their tracks a series of potholes in the snow. I held my ice axe the way Greg had taught me, and stepped into one of the potholes. Its existence made my life both harder and easier. I didn't have to chip my own steps, but those of the men were awkwardly placed and slippery, and sometimes so deep that my boot got trapped inside and I'd lose my balance and fall, my ice axe so unwieldy it felt more like a burden than an aid. Arrest, I kept thinking, imagining what I'd do with the axe if I started to slide down the slope. The snow was different from the snow in Minnesota. In some places it was more ice than flake, so densely packed it reminded me of the hard layer of ice in a freezer that needs defrosting. In other places it gave way, slushier than it first appeared. I didn't look at the bank of boulders below until I'd reached the other side of the snow and was standing on the muddy trail, trembling but glad. I knew that little jaunt was only a sample of what lay ahead. If I didn't opt to get off the trail at Trail Pass to bypass the snow, I'd soon reach Forester Pass, at 13,160 feet, the highest point on the PCT. And if I didn't slip off the side of the mountain while going over that pass, I'd spend the next several weeks crossing nothing but snow. It would be snow far more treacherous than the patch I'd just crossed. But having crossed even this much made what lay ahead more real to me. It told me that I had no choice but to bypass. I wasn't rightly prepared to be on the PCT in a regular year, let alone a year in which the snow depth measurements were double and triple what they'd been the year before. There hadn't been a winter as snowy as the previous one since 1983, and there wouldn't be another for more than a dozen years. Plus, there wasn't only the snow to consider. There were also the things related to the snow, the dangerously high rivers and streams I'd need to ford alone, the temperatures that would put me at risk of hypothermia, the reality that I'd have to rely exclusively on my map and compass for long stretches when the trail was concealed by the snow. All of those made more grave by the fact that I was alone. I didn't have the gear I needed. I didn't have the knowledge and experience. And because I was solo, I didn't have a margin for error either. By bailing out like most of the other PCT hikers had, I'd miss the glory of the High Sierra, but if I stayed on the trail, I'd risk my life. I'm getting off at Trail Pass, I told Doug and Tom as we ate dinner that night. I'd hiked all day alone, logging my second 15-plus mile day, but caught up with them again as they made camp. I'm going to go up to Sierra City and get back on the trail there. We decided to push on, said Doug. We talked about it, and we think you should join us, said Tom. Join you? I asked, peering out from the tunnel of my dark fleece hood. I was wearing all the clothes I'd brought, the temperature down near freezing. Patches of snow surrounded us beneath the trees in spots shaded from the sun. It's not safe for you to go alone, Doug said. Neither one of us would go alone, said Tom. But it's not safe for any of us to go into the snow, together or alone, I said. We want to try it, said Tom. Thank you, I said. I'm touched you'd offer, but I can't. Why can't you? Doug asked. Because the point of my trip is that I'm out here to do it alone. We were silent for a while then, eating our dinners, each of us cradling a warm pot full of rice or beans or noodles in our gloved hands. I felt sad to say no, not only because I knew it meant I was opting to bypass the High Sierra, but because as much as I said I wanted to do this trip alone, I was soothed by their company. Being near Tom and Doug at night kept me from having to say to myself, I am not afraid whenever I heard a branch snap in the dark
or the wind shook so fiercely it seemed something bad was bound to happen. But I wasn't out here to keep myself from having to say I am not afraid. I'd come, I realized, to stare that fear down. To stare everything down, really. All that I